time, these sessions are building on each other a bit. How many of you are, this is the first time you've been able to attend, you didn't make it yesterday, and that's fine, that's great. So, last time I said a little bit about who I am and why I'm here and what brings me here, and I invited folks to do the same. I'm not going to redo all of that, other than to say that I'm a Midwesterner. I grew up in South Dakota, Minnesota, Iowa, went to college in Minnesota. Yes, St. Olaf, for those of you who are of that kind of Norwegian lineage or Lutheran college lineage. And I did not know a person of color until at least age 11. And that was when I was introduced to my first teacher, who was both male. My first teacher was both male and also African American, and when we moved to Chicago. I'm here this week with my wife, Allison, and our son, Ben, and you'll hear a bit more about him later with his permission. But since we can't redo all of that kind of what we bring to the table and who we are, I just want to say one thing, that we don't know who all is here, and we can't assume that if you, like me, identify as white, that you have the same experience with white socialization, that it's uniform. And if you identify as a person of color or as white but with very close family members who are people of color, you may have particular experiences with these issues that are distinct from others who are, like me, have lived more in pretty segregated lives in white communities. All of that's valid. All of that's welcome wherever we are at in our learning trajectory. So it's all good, and please don't worry about that. But I do want us to be careful with one another's stories and to try to not make assumptions that we think we're going to know what people might think or feel or say. And also, if you do identify as white, but someone who lives close proximity to these issues because of family members and loved ones and such, or if you do identify as a person of color or biracial and such, if you need to take a break, because this is kind of intense material today, no worries, no problem. But if you, like me, identify as white, I really hope you'll lean in and be a little more comfortable with being uncomfortable, because I really think it's important for our moral formation as white people to know this history that we're going to be exploring today. So this is what is happening today. We're looking at why history matters. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about, and I really think it's creative and helpful to understand a bit more about the stages of white identity formation. So for those of you who don't want to be stuck in white guilt, who don't want to feel shame, and believe me, that doesn't do anyone any good to feel shame or guilt. That's not what this is about. This is going to be, tomorrow will be really helpful in just kind of understanding how we've been socialized, many of us, and how we can move through that into some new areas of growth and understanding of ourselves. Thursday is when we're going to define racism, and we took a vote last time, and instead of talking about healthcare inequalities, we're going to watch a 24-minute video on housing discrimination and the legacy of that. So we will be looking at an issue of structural racism. But you can come up to me at lunch, dinner, after Vespers, and say, Anna, why is it that black women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die from maternal childbirth and postpartum complications than their white counterparts? And I will explain it. Or why is it that black infants are so much more likely to die in their first year of life than white infants? So we can talk about those things as well as asthma and how it is that communities of color are disproportionately living on the front lines of climate change and paying the highest prices, even though they contribute the least to it. What are you getting from me? There's a lot that I'm not going to be able to do, and it's a surplus and overflowing, and I'm happy to keep continuing the conversation with you at other times. So Thursday we'll be talking about housing and viewing 24 minutes of a video and defining racism, and then Friday is when we get concrete, pragmatic, and we really lay out strategies for being or continuing to be better and better allies and to seek justice and equity. So wherever we have spheres of influence, wherever we feel called and capable, we're going to talk about that at whatever life stage we are. So is that clear? It's a little different. It's slightly revised from what's out there. I was very ambitious out there on what I wrote. So I hope you'll find this is manageable. It's okay if you haven't read. It's okay if you can't read. All is welcome. I'll remind you what we're doing in the next couple of days at the very end of class. Okay? So come as you are and as you are able and with whatever preparation you can do. Or not. So today we're doing some history. And I just want to say welcome to everyone. I guess I do want to do this. I want you to take 30 seconds per person and introduce yourself to one person that you don't yet know. So you can say whatever you want, what brings you here, or that might be a long one. So maybe where you were before you were at Holden, anything about yourself, like two or three words, just so that we start to become familiar with one another. 30 seconds per person. Why don't you make that? I tend to be called a pretty dynamic speaker, and sometimes that means that I run like a racehorse through content because I'm so animated and excited. If you can't hear me, if you need me to slow the heck down, just please let me know. Also, feel free to ask a question at any time. And 1 second, and I may say, please give me 1 second, or I may say in a minute, or please, what is your question?
Can we open the door over there?
Yes, someone please open the door over there. Thank you for coming in on a hot day as well. So I want to begin with something that I learned this morning that maybe some of you know, but I didn't, and I was going to mention this person in my presentation anyway, but it just really struck me that we lost a hero of the United States. Toni Morrison died yesterday, which is just very, very hard for me to understand. She was 88. Death happens, I know, but I wasn't ready for that, especially on the heels of really hard mass shootings, again, that I learned about. So this is Toni Morrison when she's receiving the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2012. And I know there's so much content that I want to explore with you, but I think really it's important to just take a moment of silence to honor her contributions to our world, our society, and if you wish also to send prayers up in the names of those who have died this week, in your personal life or the shooting victims in Texas and Ohio. I think we should just take a breath. Thank you. The volume's fine? You can hear me so far? We're okay? All right. Toni Morrison, I added this morning to the presentation because it really fits. When she was receiving the Nobel Prize in 1993, she gave us an important warning. Oppressive language does not merely represent violence. It is violence. And it doesn't merely represent the limits of knowledge. It limits knowledge. And when we talk about history and how we remember history, how we tell history, I think that we need to understand that certain ways of representing history are actually violent and are limiting of knowledge. And I say that as a woman who grew up in South Dakota. I talked about a lot more about this last time, but for now I'll just say that I was a kid in the 70s who, when we went through Wall Drug towards the Black Hills, wanted the Native American headdresses and the plastic rubber tomahawks that they had to sell, who would love to go and dress up for Halloween as either a cowboy or an Indian. And I had no idea until many years later why that might be an issue. And so I started to explore history in my work in ethics and started to learn more and more why history matters. And what is and isn't taught, and how it's taught. It pays forward. History is not something dusty that lives on a shelf in the library. It breathes into the present. So these are just a few images that are too easy to find. And they are certain representations of history. Christian history, American history, who Jesus is and was. So we really have to think about what stories we tell carefully and what kind of narratives we allow to stand. So I was asked by a friend last night to say a little bit about the origins of black and white. So I added this as well. And it's a mad dash. So I want to just reference two things. One is that if you don't know the anthropologist Nina Jablonski, she's outstanding, and she has this 14-minute TED Talk on just laying out how race is a social construction, how it has all to do with how close to the equator your people lived and how species needed to adapt in order to either protect themselves from the sun rays or garner more than they, you know, the few months that they had to really gather. So it's just fascinating. It's very wonderful. But nonetheless, when we say that race is a social construction, that it was an adaptive kind of thing that happened in terms of skin pigmentation and melanin. Race is real, nonetheless. It has effects because of the social, political, economic effects that it has. So, the origins of black and white. How did, this question that I was asked was, when did we start to associate negative things with black or positive with white? So just do a 2-minute thought experiment. Write on a piece of paper if you have it. If you don't, here's some. I was taught by another friend of mine how good it is to write in longhand a little bit and how our brains free up when we do that. So don't just think it. I want you to write it. And just, I'll time you again, but we're just, for a minute or two, just lay it out there. What adjectives come to mind with white and black for you? This is what Malcolm X experienced in his life. And is it still true today? Just try and, I kind of spoiled it by saying too much, but try to do it without that in mind. Free association. Yes.
So just the colors, black and white.
Yeah. What do adjectives come to mind?
Skin color or just the colors?
No, just the colors.
Just the colors.
Okay, just another 30 seconds. There's a chair if you would like, right here. Was incarcerated and began the process of conversion that led to his conversion to Islam before he even took the name Malcolm X. He was shown a dictionary and compared the definitions of white and black. What did you come up with? What are a few just quick examples? What do we hear and think of? Yes, go ahead.
I have white is angels and light.
Oh, yeah.
Black is death and devil.
Right? Others?
Night and day.
Night and day? Go ahead.
Black was mysterious, dirty, dark, dangerous. White, pure, clean, bright, what you head towards.
And just think about the literature you read. Even in these shootings, a dark day in history. Evil, right? But why does it have to be dark? I love Harry Potter, but the dark arts. Yet, why can't we say something is sinister? What kinds of adjectives can we come up with? Then again, yes, pure as the driven snow, unblemished, unbesmirched, unsoiled. Even if we're going to get into lies, white lies for some are not as bad as the other lies. Or white collar crime. What's up with that? How do we get here? Well, I wish that I could be Lin-Manuel Miranda. I really wish that I could do a really great dynamic musical number right now. But instead, what I'm going to do is give you too many text-heavy slides, and you're going to hate it, and I'm sorry, and hopefully it won't be too awful. But it's a lot of history that I'm trying to do in a few minutes. Virginia was the first state, I'm sorry, colony at the time, to distinguish indentured servant from slave as who could be held into perpetuity as well as their descendants versus who would be able to pay off their servitude and then be free and have their future generations. In the 1705 then, all blacks, mulattoes, Native Americans, all non-Christian persons, even if they later converted to Christianity, and that's important, were considered slaves or the enslaved. The law went on to state that all slaves shall be held to be real estate. Such laws, in effect, put all power in the hands of the master. And that then started. So when the colonists were arriving, when the very first settlers came from the European continent, they weren't already calling themselves white. They were calling themselves English or Dutch or French, etc. But the process of becoming white had to do with legal codes that the legal slavery was encoded through law. And these laws separated then who was black, meaning those who could be held into perpetuity and their descendants, and who could not. Who had rights to take you to court? Who could go to court? Who could sue? And who could not? So this starts in the late 1600s and early 1700s. These lines in legal codes are starting to be drawn. And as you also know, many of you who have immigrant families in your lineage, as I do, know that some folks from Southern Europe and also from Ireland were considered black. They were not the same as Germans or Norwegians. Well, not as many Norwegians were coming at that time, but English and such. So, but over time, they could distinguish themselves through work and education and such, and the newer immigrants became more dark. So these things fluctuate in time is what I want to understand. So to answer my friend's question, well, it's historical. Through legal codes, we start to associate. But it's also through just the history of colonization that when people went to lands they had not been to before and found other kinds of people, they made some pretty quick judgments in their diaries and journals about who was civilized and who wasn't, and what was scary and what was not, and such. But another answer to that question goes way before modern colonial history, to the Bible. So we have to take a look at the biblical and natural arguments that were made. And I think that a lot of times people like to think that those who owned people, those who owned slaves, or those who colonized the West and moved Native Americans off the land were not so much rooted in their Christian faith. It wasn't as important to them as others. And that's really not true. I think we really have to own the fact that actually in white Christianity we have very deep roots that are justifying of these practices. So here's where Exodus begins in Ephesians. These were certainly recited by preachers, by slave masters, who were also sometimes one and the same people in their communities, often. I'm not going to read this right now, but you can note it. And then I want you to know that well before the Protestant Reformation, so before we can say there's any distinction between Lutherans and Catholics or any of that sort, in the late 1400s, the first papal documents were written, which started to form the doctrine of discovery. And again, I don't want to read all of this right now, but the idea is that it started to give justification to those colonizing these newly discovered lands, at least to those people. They weren't new to others who had come even earlier. That the first time, this papal bull of 1463, right around the time of the Crusades, it was the first time, though, that the papacy made it look as though no one was living there and had no ownership to the land. It's just open. It's all there for us because there are no Christians there. So you don't count. You're not fully human. You're another species. That was the first. But then later, in 1452, we have the next one, Dum Diversas, which says that the Portuguese crown authority to invade, capture, vanquish, and subdue all of these kinds of people who are inherently enemies of Christ because they're not Christians, and put them into perpetual slavery and take away all of their possessions and property. In 1454, another bull entitled Romanus Pontifex further stated that kind of thinking and sanctified the seizure of non-Christian lands in parts of Africa and restating the legitimacy of enslaving non-Christians. In 1493, that was a year after Columbus's fateful voyage, Inter Cateterra granted Ferdinand and Isabella full and free power, authority, and jurisdiction over every kind, over almost all of the Americas. So more bulls followed. And look at this one again. This is Inter Cateterra blown up a bit more. This was in 1823. This was cited in Johnson versus McIntosh, Chief Justice John Marshall's opinion, and the unanimous decision held that the principle of discovery gave European nations an absolute right to New World lands. In essence, American Indians had only a right of occupancy, which could be abolished. So now, we, those of us who identify as Protestant might want to say, man, those Catholics, but come on. This is... when does Luther enter the scene? 1517 and such. So we're inheriting this as well. We can't just divorce ourselves from it. So then I just want to let you know there are other biblical justifications that really are prominent in the 18th and 19th centuries. So there's the curse of Ham, Noah's son, who embarrassed him. So that means that all of Ham's descendants should be servants. The Ten Commandments mention slavery twice. God doesn't seem to mind. Slavery was widespread throughout the Roman world, yet Jesus never spoke against it. The Apostle Paul specifically commands the enslaved to obey their masters. Paul returns a runaway slave, Philemon, to his master. So these were all used as justifications. But then there were also this social reasons and, again, the rise of the Enlightenment and the natural world and the study of anthropology. So there was a blending of both scientific inquiry and justification as well as religious. But the idea is, how many of you have heard this term natural law before? Brand new to a lot of you. So natural law, you can say, first started with Aristotle and then Aquinas and then reinvents it and reinterprets it, Christianizes it. And basically here it is. Natural laws, the idea is that there is a natural order in the world. That order is given by God, it's good, and it should be maintained. And we human beings, through the use of our reason, our intellectual capacities, we can participate in the natural law. So, but not every species is the same. Not every being is the same. Angels are higher than humans. Humans are higher than all the animals. Animals are higher than rocks. So there's a great chain of being, a hierarchy. Should have had a nice picture for you. So, and the other idea that Aquinas had is that women are human, but they don't have the same rational capacity as men, so that's why they're suited to the home, right? So these distinctions are made. Now remember, this order is given in nature. It is good. It should be maintained. The natural law arguments have certainly been used against same-sex couples and queer folks, right? You're going against the natural order of creation. But so too with slavery. The idea is that there's a natural order. Certain people, certain species are made to control, to organize, to rule, to govern. Others are much more suited for manual labor, for taking directions. They need care. The analogy that is given by white Christian preachers who are in support of slavery is that just as God is over humanity, so too the white person is over in charge of the slaves. Or just as parents are in charge of their children, children don't have complete freedom and autonomy, so too, the slave owners should be like benevolent parents who are taking care of these people who can't, well, not even people, who can't take care of themselves. So that's a kind of natural law thinking that justifies the social hierarchy. And we see that surfacing, I bet we can come up with examples still today, whether it's related to gender, sexuality, race and such. So, and I just wanted to underscore that there was a whole lot being written and preached of justifying slavery from white Christians. And they were working in consortium with a lot of the anthropologists at the time who were doing a lot of mapping of the races. and giving innate qualities to certain races. Measuring skulls, measuring nose, all of that stuff was going on. So then these are the last reasons I'll mention that were given in the 18th and 19th century. So we're doing them a favor. We're removing them from sorcery and witchcraft and the devil. We are bringing them to a Christian land where they can hear the gospel. This is what their order, this is what they were called to be. This is living into their purpose. It's natural. And, you know, hey, we treat them very well. These people, they aren't going hungry. They have important work to do. It's in their interest. You know, it's in the interest of slave owners to treat their enslaved well because they're property. They cost money to replace. And they even argue that they're treated better than the people in oppressive northern factories. And maybe in certain situations they were. So all of that seems like ancient history. But the idea was that if you start, I mean, yes, there were Christian abolitionists, absolutely. But I think sometimes we want to give ourselves a whole lot of credit there and not really own about the major stream that those Christian abolitionists were working against. This is a cartoon from the time. If you think, if you start to question the legitimacy and naturalness of slavery, that's the devil talking. If you want to know more about the history of slavery, you know, we have the amazing African American Museum now in D.C., but the Whitney Plantation is the only museum dedicated to telling the whole story of the enslaved. It's outside of New Orleans, Louisiana. It is phenomenal. I could tell you so much more about it, but I won't right now. I also really encourage you to check out the Library of Congress and hear from the archives slave narratives of the enslaved that have been recorded. But now, it raises, this history does really raise hard issues for those of us who identify as white. Some of us, our ancestors did own slaves. Again, the Catholic Church owned slaves, 272 in the case of Georgetown, that then the Jesuits sold in order to save, to make Georgetown more viable at the time. And they have just recently engaged a process of reparation, saying, what do we owe the descendants of those enslaved that we sold? And are working with the Whitney Plantation to explore that. And in fact, if you can show through the lineage and documentation that you are a descendant of one of those 272 individuals, and you qualify in terms of the basic requirements for admission, you can go to Georgetown for free, is one of the things that, one of the action steps that they have taken. That's one part of the story that I wanted to tell you. The other part is related to indigenous populations and Native Americans. So who do you know? Who is this person? Oh, he is indeed. So there are two basic charts trajectories that I want to just mention. One is the forced removal and extermination of Native peoples. This is the case of the, in the case of the Cherokee, that had to move, be put out of their land in 1830. And that was one major devastating strategy. At least 4,000 Cherokee died on that forced march. But then we have to not just focus on Andrew Jackson, because Abraham Lincoln, who never ordered the execution of Confederate soldiers or officers, on Christmas, the day after Christmas, December 26, 1862, executed, had the ordered 150 Lakota who had rebelled. Now, so extermination, forced removal was one strategy. The other strategy, predominant strategy, was conversion. Almost white. So here is a priest with Native Americans, probably Lakota, but I'm not sure. But more and more, they were, again, removed from lands, but taken to schools. Children were taken away from their parents, taught to dress in a different manner, not allowed to use their language, their native languages, would be beaten and punished for doing so. And so the idea was, we can assimilate. They can become like us, but not quite. So this is an inadequate history. But I want you to know that Christians were very much central to a lot of these schools that were set up, Indian schools, in the Dakotas, in Canada, and elsewhere. And what I've done is just summarize key points from this reading that was in the library, okay? So it's pretty fraught, and it can raise a lot of feelings. And that's what I'd like you to discuss right now. I would like you to get in groups of about four people. I'd like you to talk to at least two people that you do not already know. And I'd like you to take, I'll check in with you, but in about 10 minutes, or 15, we'll see. I'd like us to have some large group conversation as well. But I'd like you to begin with what was new or thought-provoking, and I do apologize for how fast that was, if you need me to go over something. What feeling surfaced? And am I onto something? Is this relevant for 2019? So take a few minutes. Again, at least two other people that you don't know already. We only have a few minutes, and I promised a story each time. And I am going to tell you the story that I promised about the conversation I had with my son about hair when he was 8. But before I do that, I think it's important to lift up a few things that you've discussed that seem important for others to hear or to ask. So anyone want to report back from your group or some things that bubbled up here as well? This is not Vegas.
You're safe.
Surprised that Abraham Lincoln voted for the execution of the Indians.
Yeah.
On the other hand, depends on what the circumstances were, but still, you know, you wouldn't necessarily expect that given the same what he did for Black Americans. So,
yeah, and that's complicated too, for sure. But the idea is that the contrast between a whole group of states saying we're seceding from the Union, were that his tone was so different in terms of reconciliation for basically these Lakota who were saying we want our own nation and we, you know, that kind of thing. But yes, there's always. I want to honor what you just said, that there's a whole lot more context than what I've done in a very short presentation just to try to give us some food for thought.
Right.
Let's keep going. Others? Yes, go ahead.
How far back this went? Like, all the way to the 1400s? That was a bit of a surprise.
Yeah.
Then also the piece about whiteness wasn't defined. It almost became defined because they were defined as slavery.
Much later, absolutely. Yep, encoded. Racialized legal codes. Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Yeah, one of the things we talked about was history repeats itself, and it's done that forever.
Yeah, but it keeps changing too, so we don't always recognize it.
Mm.
Racism is not the same as it was in the 1700s or 1800s, but it's not gone. But yes, there are some things that keep popping up, and we have to have build really acute sensitivities and sensibilities to be able to have our antenna aware. Other thoughts? Go ahead.
We talked a little bit about why we are not taught these things as children, and what the history of our nation is that we were taught as children in our schools. And then Alex added that we're taught more at the college level, and we tried to discern why that is.
And depending on where you go and what you take, you are taught. There's a lot of variation there. Was there a hand in the back or up here?
No, but I will.
All right.
Something I read in graduate school some years ago to deal with the question of slavery being in the Bible. Somebody done serious research in it to determine that virtually all slavery, American slavery, is virtually the only slavery context which is race-based. And thus, you could never get out of it because you couldn't shed your race.
Yeah, it's true. And what James Cone for years so prophetically and powerfully stated is saying, Christian brothers and sisters who are white, why are you not addressing this? Why are you not striking at the core of our tradition here on this? Go ahead.
Kind of along those lines, you're talking a little bit about how the whole use of social construct, the whole idea of race, the construct meaning that you're using skin color to divide people and categorize them, whereas it's just a gene, and you could have done it by hair color or
it's adaptation,
some other thing that had nothing to do with skin color.
Yeah. You know? So I'm noticing that I really appreciate these thoughts and insights, and I'm glad that some of this material was new and thought-provoking, but I'm noticing that we haven't really addressed this one. I mean, in speaking about these things with you today, my stomach's in a knot. I was pretty perky yesterday, and I am a pretty perky person, but this stuff is hard to do. Of course, it's nothing like living it and being the object, being in the bullseye of all of this. But I think a lot of times white people don't want to go down this road because it means that they assume it means that they have to feel crappy about themselves. Mm-hmm. And I just can't say this often enough, that guilt and shame are not what this is about. And that guilt and shame is not the same thing as taking responsibility. I did not choose to be born into the family. I didn't choose the skin color. But I can choose what I do with my social location. I can choose how I act in the world. And that's where we are going in the next three sessions. So it is going to be constructive, all right? We can face this history. We can survive dealing with this and grappling with it and not just kind of skipping over it to diversity is great, let's celebrate it. And we will be better partners. We will be more trustworthy allies. We will be better friends if we don't shrink from this. But we also cannot let it consume us in a way that we get stuck and demoralized and cynical and embarrassed. Because then you stop showing up, right? And that doesn't help anybody at all. So let me just tell you a story, with my son's permission, about how I tried to navigate this terrain and why history matters when it comes to Halloween costumes. I told you already that as a kid, some of my costume choices. Well, I want to go back and recall The Bluest Eye from Toni Morrison, where she speaks so powerfully about how, again, what we take as beauty, how what we assume is the norm and beauty, how that can be internalized by certain peoples so that then they never measure up. And that can happen in terms of gender and sexuality, in terms of place, race and class, in terms of body type and all of that. But that novel that she wrote is so powerful because it talks about how the main character wanted to have blue eyes. And I can tell you that there have been many psychological studies with children of color and how oftentimes they will still, in this day and age, choose white dolls as the good dolls to play with over dolls that look like them. Because they have internalized that they are not as good or as pretty or as neat. So in my history, in my family, it wasn't the eyes, it was the hair. And I wrote about this in an op-ed piece in 2015 when my son Ben was then 15. No, he's 12 when he was then 8. 2015. And it'll take me about 5 minutes. Is it okay if I read it? I've heard his parts of it. I know I've talked a lot today. I want you to... what's going to happen tomorrow? Not as many PowerPoints. We're not going to be just rolling through text. And I will not talk as fast, all right? I did so much history so fast, but it won't be just like that tomorrow. So please don't be afraid. The hair. Reflections by a white parent. In infancy, it was the eyes. But ever since toddlerhood, it's been the hair. So what, some people might ask. Why mention it? Because so many others do. My son receives compliment about the color of his hair from people that he knows and from people on the street every week. We live in Chicago, so if it were Minnesota, maybe it'd be a little different. Adults have stopped me and said, "Do you bleach his hair?" And I'm like, "No, I didn't do it. I did not touch it." Anyway, all shades and all colors of people smile and they tussle his hair, they pat him on the back, they tell him that he looks like a movie star and that he's beautiful. I mention this because I see the pride that he takes in his appearance and the confidence in his walk. I mention it because I don't see other hair colors garnering so much positive attention from complete strangers. I mention it because of how early this color has shaped his sense of self and because of the way that he is received by others. And you see, I see how fast people, other parents, teachers, people in authority, size up kids. Who's cute? Who's a troublemaker? Who's outgoing? Who's hyper? Who's clever? Who's smart? Even more, I mention it because I'm trying to raise a white boy with a healthy sense of self-esteem. But I do not want it to be built on a foundation that depends on the undervaluing of others, implicitly or explicitly. What is this called? This is called towhead, by the way, right? Mm-hmm. Color of straw. Mm-hmm. My sister, I was like this when I was a kid. My sister, she did not have this. You know what my family actually called her hair color? Anybody guesses?
Dishwater blonde.
Dishwater blonde, yes. So,
yes, there's that.
It did not do her any good. The person that we see reflected in the eyes and in the responses of others etches very strong impressions into our psyches about ourselves. It affects our self-esteem profoundly. Here's a counterexample. Recently in a park with my family, I encountered a lovely dark brown boy, maybe he was 2 or 3, walking with his family. As he passed me on the path, I said, "Why, hello there," and I smiled at him. He replied with a resolute "No," and a scowl. A family member reproached him and said, "Well, she wasn't being mean to you, she was just saying hi." "So what?" one might retort. "Maybe he was just being a typical 2 or 3-year-old who says no to everything." Maybe. Or perhaps he was reflecting his prior experiences with other white people telling him not to do stuff, correcting him, or maybe even showing him that they're wary of him through subtle or not so subtle body language, rather than greeting him with friendliness and a smile. I don't know. But to me, his reaction to me, a white stranger, said a lot more about white society than it did about his age or his personality. But back to my son. He was 8 when I wrote this again. Many describe him as an old soul. He feels profoundly sad for sick and wounded and dying people and animals. He talks about his feelings. He loves to read, and we talk about war and dramatic physical contests of force and skill, from Harry Potter to World War II trivia. Well, my son might have peace and justice moms, but the boy loves to learn about machines, vehicles, spies, crime-fighting, technology, and weapons. And he also expresses a deep respect for police and for those who serve in the military. As his parents, we have encouraged respect, and we have also spoken honestly, explaining to him that these persons are called to protect and to serve, but that they also make mistakes. He knows about police brutality in Ferguson. It makes him mad. He knows the name of Michael Brown. He has chanted at public demonstrations with us and others from our church that Black Lives Matter. Well, anyway, the other day on the street, we're starting to talk about Halloween costumes. By the way, this was in August. He plans ahead. And he said that he probably wants to be a soldier from the World War II era. And I asked him what nationality he might want to represent. And he replied, "Probably German." You see, we'd seen Nazi uniforms in books and in a museum. And to him, they were the most attractive. Well, but think about it. That's the look that the Nazis were going for. Fierce, stylish, and intimidating. They were dressing to impress. So what do I do with this? My toe-headed child, without fully comprehending it, basically wants to be a Nazi for Halloween. How do I talk about this in a way that does not shame him? Well, logically, the first thing we did was go get frozen custard. We sat down, and then I broached the topic by asking him to tell me how he would define the word symbol. Now, that was hard. His answer was a bit vague. So we clarified, and I tried to explain that a symbol is a visual representation of an idea that can't be explained quickly, that it stands in for or it embodies an idea. Then, because we've been talking a lot about ancient Greece and Rome, we talked about the example of the eagle being a part of the presidential seal and that it had once stood for the Roman emperor. We also talked about how the Nazis reappropriated a several thousand-year-old symbol, now known as a swastika, which had meant originally something completely different than it did for the Nazis. Then I asked him how he thought his classmates might feel if he came to school on Halloween dressed as a World War II German soldier. His eyes got big. He had a dawning expression that came over him, and he looked at me slowly and he said, "I never thought of it that way." After a short pause, I mentioned the hoods and the sheets of the Ku Klux Klan that they'd also learned about in second grade. And we talked about that, and we talked previously about that at home. In short, my son imagined how his friends might feel, some of whom happened to be Jewish and or darker skinned or darker haired than he is. When he thought about them, then he had an epiphany about costumes. He realized it's one thing to want to be scary, like Voldemort or a ghost, but quite another to symbolize a living terror who has reigned and who still reigns terror and harm and death on people in our world, in our nation, in our city. As parents and as teachers, I think we have to risk these kinds of conversations. We must never underestimate what children as young as this and even younger are capable of understanding, and how much they are being shaped by what we do and do not offer them. So, my son will not be a Nazi for Halloween. And if he asks, no, he's not going to be a police officer either. Not now, not given the moment in which we live. And this was, again, right after Ferguson. Not with that hair. And I'll do my best to explain why. So that was a little glimpse. And Ben, he's here. So I really want you to hear you can be proud of your hair and you can be proud of who you are. You don't have to feel guilty. You didn't ask to be born with that wonderful hair.
I know.
All right. Do you want to add anything to the story now that you're 12?
What was the costume?
Yeah, what did you put? Yeah, I know what
you did. Oh, what was the costume?
I think you were the Grim Reaper.
You did so much better.
You'll take it, right?
Yeah.
So
I would never want to shame him, and I would never want to shame any of us, but I do want us to be understanding of how our bodies are embodying history. This body has history that I'm carrying with me. I'm not chained to it in a way that I can't act creatively, but I need to take ownership. That's what I'm hoping we get out of today. Remember, tomorrow we're going to look at really interesting stages of white identity formation. How do we understand ourselves better? How do we understand our relatives? How can we move forward? Thursday, we'll be looking at housing, structural racism, and housing discrimination. And Friday is when we're really going to craft strategic responses for our own lives and spheres of influence. Last note, we are at 5 and we're hungry. But I want you to take one, if you didn't get one last time, the reading, just suggested readings and websites, podcasts, and movies, organizations to connect with. So in case you cannot come back again, you have that with you. And I also cannot say, if you are a parent or a grandparent, I cannot recommend highly enough Raising White Kids. It is accessible, it's engaging, it gives us wonderful resources for raising our children and having these kinds of conversations. It's outstanding. Also great for book groups and individual reflection. Waking Up White, a personal memoir, just kind of a woman coming, sharing her own story and what we can do with that. And from Seattle, Ijoma Oluo, So You Want to Talk About Race. So wonderfully engaging and easy to read. And if you're really up for a challenge, it's also exceptional. White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism.
Anna, which one is the best for like a congregational book study?
I think that Waking Up White, if it's parents, if it's a congregational study of parents. I also think this is outstanding for college students, young adults, and adults. It could work really well. So those are just three examples. There's more on your handout. Take one if you didn't get one last time. Thank you for being patient with me through a lot of slides.